Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Thank you, everybody, and welcome back. I already introduced Michael already in the earlier session. We're running a little late, so we're going to dispense with that and ask Michael to start his presentation. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much. So, Grüß Gott. It's wonderful to be here at Ars Electronica. It's not often that I get a chance to address a new conference. I go to a lot of the old same conferences, so this is a treat for me. And let me explain a little bit about my journey getting here. You may know from my biography that I started hacking free software in 1987 and started the world's first company founded on a business model based on free software in 1989. Our tagline was, "We make free software affordable." And the thing that got me into that was I started out as a researcher in a proprietary institute. I was graded very highly. The institute was extremely well-funded. And the very first time I did any project there, the shareholders gave me great applause. We had a special event. And 6 months later, I asked the shareholders, "So who, if anybody, is using this technology?" And the answer was unanimous: nobody, because it was too advanced. And this tore me up inside, this idea, whether or not it was too advanced, we'll never know, but it tore me up inside that all this work would come to nothing, and the agreement that I had signed of turning over my intellectual property to somebody supposedly better able to exploit it became a fallacy. And so when I learned about free software, I recognized that as an opportunity that never again would I be deprived from the fruits of my own labor. And if others could benefit, if others could profit, if I could profit, that's all good. But I would never be in a situation where I created something that I could not come back to sometime in the future and use it or make it better. Now, I think that the model that I have developed, the model that I saw developed around Cygnus, which was later acquired by Red Hat, has been a phenomenal success story. I'm extremely proud of the commercial success. I'm extremely proud of the industry that we have created, which is now estimated to drive multiple billions of dollars a year in software and services revenue, and tens of billions of dollars a year when hardware revenues attached are included. And today, I see a similar disconnect in the world of music production, and especially the music industry. Very few musicians, in fact, I have not talked to one, who tells me that the music industry either works for their benefit or necessarily even works any longer as originally designed. The number of artists who are deprived from their work and the number of artists who have no proper context or ability to perform their work is, I think, a cultural tragedy. And so I have begun a personal project to prototype a new way to solve this problem, and it was very opportune that Joey contacted me about this conference, because this project that I'm developing, I hope, is a prototype that others replicate in their own world. So I'm going to talk about music, software, and sustainable culture. And I'm going to start by just showing a little video walkthrough of this environment that I am building. For those of you who are curious, we have built up to the foundation. We are awaiting some finalization of electrical plans before pouring the slab, and construction is expected to finish next year. So that's what the environment might look like. Now, in the proceedings of the conference, I wrote a paper that talks about this project in a much more general way. And we start by looking at this question of what is culture, and a related question, what is music? And when you look again at the etymology of culture, you see that it comes from this Latin term to cultivate. And this concept of cultivation is therefore very closely tied to something that I think we all understand, and that is the concept of the land. And the paper develops the analogies between the concepts of land and property, the concepts of land and productive value. But it also, according to the Wikipedia entry, culture tells us that it's not only about consumption, it's also about production and the processes which produce such goods, and as Yochai so elegantly said this morning, gives them their meaning. And a related subject which I've become very involved in is sustainable farming practices. A couple of years ago I read The Omnivore's Dilemma, and my response to that book was to join something called the Center for Environmental Farm Systems, which is a 2,000-acre organic farm research facility in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And we just won some grants this year, which makes me confident to say it's the premier such facility in the United States of America. But we are at a moment in time where the power of technology is putting the potential of the soil at extraordinary risk. It is estimated that the U.S. will have depleted its topsoil with the last barrel of oil used to provide unnecessary fertilization at the same time that we will no longer have any such oil to produce these fertilizers, which we will then need. It is unbelievable, the predicament that we're creating for ourselves that will possibly come to pass in the next 40 to 50 years. This concept of the viability of the soil and its potential relates to the question of musical culture in sort of an interesting way. Here is an excerpt I retrieved from Alex Ross's book, The Rest is Noise. This is a letter that Wagner sent to Liszt in 1850. And he says, "I have felt the pulse of modern art and know that it will die. This knowledge, however, fills me not with despondency, but with joy." And he concludes that it is important to live in the present, in the here and now, and create works for the present age alone. Of course, people still listen to Wagner, so he was obviously not successful. But what this shows is an extraordinary confidence in the creative soils of European culture in 1850. The freedom to choose whether to eat the seed or to plant it is the freedom that comes from knowing that the soil is still viable, that the soil is still fertile. And what makes me happy is that there are still some who see that viability today. The Police finished up their worldwide tour. They earned $144 million in the US and $340-some million in a worldwide farewell tour. And the quote that concluded the tour from Stuart Copeland should make anyone in the Creative Commons absolutely thrilled. He says, "We're proud of this enormous monster we've created, but it owns us. The music doesn't even belong to us anymore. It belongs to the people into whose lives it is woven. The only way to get our lives back is to slay this thing." This is the same sentiment that Wagner and numerous other composers in the modern era have expressed, this idea that we must have the freedom to create, and that may mean the freedom to destroy as well. But what we should not destroy is the potential of creativity. And this is the great risk I fear that we are in, because there are some people who fear death so much that they are willing to sacrifice birth in order to prevent the death of their ownership of some copyrighted work. And so the paper develops this theme quite extensively, and I commend it to you in the proceedings. Let me now talk more specifically about my small project. So if you are familiar with the slow food movement, you know Carlo Petrini talks about eating as an agricultural act. And he talks about the fact that what the farmer produces and the eater consumes is actually a co-productive process in the agricultural cycle. Eating is an agricultural act, and the eater is a principal actor in the act of co-production. Now, how does this work with music? I saw this Crafter Manifesto at an open source conference a number of years ago, and it remains one of my favorite lists of all time. The Crafter Manifesto expresses sentiments that every artist I have shown this to resonates strongly with. One of my favorite ones is this idea that, number two, the things that people have made themselves have magical powers, hidden meanings that other people can't see. And this idea, I think, is one of the reasons, Yochai, why this architecture of participation and also this urge to participate is because we feel within ourselves compelled to actually create magic, not just sit there and watch somebody deceive us. And so this Crafter Manifesto, I think, provides a lot of the explanations of the motivations. And we see this elegantly articulated 100 years ago by Nobel Prize winner Rabindranath Tagore when he says, "The singer alone does not make a song. There has to be someone who hears. One man opens his throat to sing. The other sings in his mind." This is the essence of how I understand musical co-production. I feel an active participant when I am in an environment that allows such musical response. Now, I won't get too far onto my soapbox, but I think that there are many ways that we have constructed musical environments where it really is not possible to sing in one's own mind because the music being blasted into our brains is coming in at such a high level of decibel that all we can do is survive the assault. Just my opinion. Now, another way of looking at this musical co-production thing, which also speaks to my understanding, is what Werner Heisenberg said in his quantum physics teachings. The act of observing alters the reality being observed. And this has very important implications for art, because artists talk about the artistic intention, which is completely valid, but one must also understand not just the audience experience, but how the experience of the audience necessarily alters the reality of the intention. And so if all this quantum art is taking place, then why not create an environment that makes this explicit rather than implicit, which activates this energy rather than leaves it a passive force? And so if we look at how the slow food movement has awakened the consciousness of the gastronomes around the world, why can't we do the same thing for music? Why can't we recognize that the artist, the engineer, and the co-producers are in a collaborative act? And today, the music industry divides these three and in ridiculous fashion makes it so that when an engineer has finished the work, there is no second version. Unless, of course, the engineer, like Phil Spector, is indicted for murder, at which point it actually becomes culturally and contractually permissible to remix the Beatles, to throw away the wall of sound as maybe not the only possible interpretation of how the Beatles' music should be experienced, giving us Let It Be Naked. But it's rare that we have access to the content at the engineering level, and it's rare that these musical listeners and co-producers have the opportunity to not just sing in their mind, but to use what technology gives all of us, the power to edit to our own preferences. So the Creative Commons has done a phenomenal job of creating a context in which these conversations can take place. It allows the artists to have their say on the preservation of the integrity of their work and to gain recognition of their authentic intention. But it also recognizes the equal and a vitally important aspect of the experience. And as lawyers and psychologists and neuroscientists may debate, when does reading become copying? When does listening become performance? We can also look at the economic questions and the questions of collaboration. How is it that that the motivation provided by the fans informs the works of the artist? In the turn of the century, Gustav Mahler was tremendously vexed by the question of whether or not vox populi was or was not vox dei when it came to criticism of his music. He was completely ambivalent about whether or not popular acclaim meant he had done a good job or not nearly a good enough job. but that tension certainly informed his work and the work of countless other composers, and it informs the work of the musical artist today. We cannot discount that in the chain of production. And so what I'm looking to do is I'm looking to create an environment where, number one, absolutely, an authentic experience can be had. There is no question that the artist and the audience together in that moment have shared the full potential of that moment, but because it's going to be a recording studio, because it will have full media capture capabilities, we will be able to capture something. What will it be? Will it be a memento? Will it be an artifact? Will it be a product? Will it be all three? If it's remixed on YouTube, how far does the chain of authenticity travel? Does new authenticity travel as new co-producers remix it, as we have seen in Yochai's video streams? So in short, and I'll wrap this up because I think I'm running low on time, the idea is to create an environment of impeccable sound that will provide the technology, not just electronic technology, but acoustic performance that will be no compromise to the performers, and it will provide engineers with the best environment we know how to design with science today for making their products. But then finally, inviting co-producers into the environment so that they can participate much more fully than they would as passive consumers. So to give you an idea, this is the floor plan. And the room that we're sitting in, I estimate, my metric is a little bit bad, but I estimate that this room is about twice the size of the music room. The reason for the small size was we wanted to maintain a visual connection between the engineer in the control room and possibly isolated performers in the music booths on the far side. But this is the basic idea of the floor plan. And if the video went by too fast, yes, there will be a piano. The acoustic environment has been optimized so that a solo piano is fully expressed in this large chamber. This is a wider view with a slightly different perspective. A view inside the isolation booth. You can see a lot of acoustic technologies being deployed, diffusion, absorption, isolation. View looking from the booths. You can see the control room in the background. A more direct view. And a view inside the control room. The empty space in the mixer is designed to support digital mixing technologies that people may bring in or may have supplied by the studio. And this is what it might look like if you attempt to lock audio to video. That image, by the way, is a Creative Commons image from Big Buck Bunny, the second 3D animation project, open 3D animation project from the Blender Institute in Amsterdam. And so we have done it for food, or we are doing it for food. We are creating a new economy of food that is good, clean, and fair. Good meaning the food is actually good to eat. It gives pleasure when eaten. It is clean, meaning it does not destroy the environment in the process of making it. And it is fair in that the farmer, the chef, all the people in that system are fairly compensated. We believe that we can reestablish an economic basis whereby authenticity can be preserved, different channels of distribution can be priced differently, and ultimately we can produce music, which is good, which means excellent to listen to, clean meaning environmentally and economically sustainable, and fair in that the musicians will actually earn a living. And then finally, I'll just leave you with this one little strange connection. Of course, the human body depends upon food, and as I think about it, I recognize that music is this primal cultural artifact that actually can be transmitted. And that this idea that music is sort of the original telekinetics, that was the basis of the Dune series of science fiction books. But it's fascinating to me that music represents such a primal and important basis of technology. But when you look at our evolutionary processes, yet the ear actually evolved from the jaw. And so if we are concerned about feeding our bodies with good food, we should be concerned that we feed our soul with good music through that extension of how we consume everything. So come to the table. And everything in here is Creative Commons attribution. Thank you very much.